ghastly pushpen. "That is where the blood moonstone is," says Elizabeth, pointing. I squat down to get a better look at the makeshift map. Where is that? I try to imagine modern-day Salem overlaid on the berries and wet dirt. Winter Island? I look from Travis to Isabella, and then to Elizabeth. "Yes," she says thoughtfully. "Winter Island. There was a fort for defense of the town. But it was also a place for selling and drying fish. Dozens of ships passed through there every day."
"It's a park now," I say. "People go there to camp and vacation."
"A park with a lighthouse," Isabella says, looking thoughtful. She gazes up to meet my eyes. "If anyone knows anything about the lighthouse's history, it's Principal Taylor. We need to talk to him right away. He might know if anything was dug up when they built the lighthouse, or when they tore down the old port."
"Okay," I say slowly, trying not to commit. "But what are the chances? He's not exactly our biggest fan."
"Poppy,"
says Travis. He uses the tone he adopts whenever he wants to snap sense into me.
"Principal Taylor may have been a bully in high school, but he's not a monster."
I sigh. "I hope not."
"You know I'm right," says Travis. "As always. And you're going to be the one to ask him, since you can remind him what a jerk face he was to your dad."
I smile faintly, recognizing the insult he's picked up from Aunt Danny.
"You know, maybe we should go check out the Taylor's place. Besides, I saw Principal Taylor leave our party. I bet he's home with the lights off keeping trick-or-treaters away, if he's not already asleep."
"I know a shortcut," says Isabella.
We all look at her.
"Katie and I used to be friends," she says.
"Confirmed."
Travis and I exchange glances, then give her a look, inviting more explanation.
"What? It was a long time ago," she says. "Like, when we were little kids."
I can tell she doesn't want to talk about it, which just makes me more curious.
"All right, we'll revisit that bombshell after November 1st, I say.
"Katie Taylor, really?" Travis cuts in. "Not that we're judging you," he adds quickly.
I shoot him a look, then turn to Isabella.
"Ride or die, right?"
Realizing what I said, I spin to face the ghosts.
"No offense."
But I don't see them, and I'm filled with a sudden sense of loss. They were my only line of communication to my family. I look around frantically.
"Elizabeth? Binks? Emily?"
I call out to the chilly night air. I spin back to my friends.
"Where did they go?"
"I don't know, Pops," says Travis. "Looks like we've been ghosted."
Don't let my resting witch face fool you. 20 minutes later, Travis, Isabella, and I sneak past the houses near the common. We go in single file because we're trying to be covert. So when I spot Jenny and a couple of other soccer girls from school walking in step in a clump, I hold out one arm to keep Travis and Isabella back. I peer around the corner of the brick building we're hiding behind. Katie isn't with them, but the five girls don't seem to be talking to each other anyway.
"There's something wrong with them," I hiss.
Each girl hums the same eerie tune, and they make their way slowly across the square, splitting up to look under park benches and in trash bins. It's freezing out, but the girls are still in their soccer shorts and flimsy jerseys from Mom's party, and they don't seem to mind the chill.
"It's the song," says Isabella.
Her pointed ears perk up as she tilts her head to make sure.
"I can hear it."
"Yeah, it's the angry mob spell to hunt us down," I whisper.
Juan wanders into the square, and I jump back so he doesn't spot us. Travis tries to push past me to get to his friend, but I grab him by the lab coat and push him against the wall. Juan continues, his vampire cloak flapping around his ankles. He has a faraway look on his face and doesn't seem to notice us, even though he walks right in front of us. His phone is pressed to his ear, and I catch the faintest trace of a song as he slips past. My mouth fills with the taste of buttercream frosting again, and the need to hunt down the moonstone, the spellbook, and ourselves. I swallow hard and try to block out the sound until he's safely passed. I shake my head. The best way to help him is to get the stone, I whisper.
She's right, adds Isabella.
Travis nods, looking resigned, but his eyes follow Juan until he disappears down an alley. It'll be okay, I say, and I really hope I'm right. It doesn't seem fair to leave the soccer squad or Juan wandering around in the cold and the dark, but then none of this seems fair.
Principal Taylor's place isn't far, says Isabella.
Once the coast is clear, she trots ahead of Travis and me, venturing back out onto the dark square. We follow her down a sidewalk along a row of houses, looking left and right. Isabella stops short in front of a charming yet aging house.
We're here, she says.
The yard is home to several sycamore trees with thick crowns of rounded leaves. Even in the moonlight, I can tell they've turned to bright yellows and oranges with the recent cold snaps. A bed of leaves covers the lawn and drifts onto the sidewalk. I've walked past this house 1,000 times. I've even thought of photographing the contrast of the leaves against the tree's pale, scarred trunks. But I never knew Katie Taylor lived here. I lead us down the walk and cross to the front steps, with Travis and Isabella right beside me. I can feel their eyes on me as I ring the bell to the right of the white double doors. The sound echoes through the house, and the following pause is long enough that I decide the place is deserted. That, or Principal Taylor, is actually fast asleep. I turn to my friends.
Great. Now what do we do?
Travis waves his phone.
Google's got nothing.
Think, 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 says Isabella from where she paces on the porch. We turn to go, just as a click and a snap tell me the locks on the door are being undone. One of the front doors grumbles and swings open, and we spin around to face it. Principal Taylor is standing there, in slippers and striped pajamas, looking uncertain.
Why are you here? Is Katie with you?
His eyes swing past us to the empty street. They search up and down it, linger briefly on Isabella sitting near my feet, and return to meet mine.
She's not.
We actually came here because we need your help, I say. My voice breaks when I do, and I wince, angry at myself. I clear my throat. My family needs your help.
Not interested, he says. Have a good night.
He slams the door in our faces.
So that went well, says Travis.
Isabella plants her front paws on the door, scrabbling at it.
Principal Taylor,
she shouts.
Principal Taylor, it's the mayor's daughter, and I'm not leaving until you talk to us.
Principal Taylor swings open the door again, examining the lower third of it, then looking back at me.
If your dog has scratched the paint, tell Isabella Richards that I'll charge City Hall,
he says dryly, looking around for her, and obviously not realizing she's literally right under his nose. I prickle at hearing him threaten Isabella. Poppy, focus. Your mission?
We need your help, I say firmly. Please.
Not interested,
Principal Taylor repeats in a clipped, measured voice.
Come on. We just have a question to ask you,
adds Travis.
Not you too,
Principal Taylor says, narrowing his eyes at him.
Yep, me too,
says Travis.
And I'm quitting Quiz Bowl if you don't help us.
I regret to inform you, Mr. Reese, that I do not give two figs about the Quiz Bowl team.
We're national champions,
Travis says.
I know you use us for fundraising appeals.
I clear my throat. Principal Taylor, I know you and my dad weren't exactly friends growing up, but if you help him now, it's a chance to make up for old times. Please don't leave us hanging.
Yeah,
says Travis eagerly.
We're helping you help yourself. Something terrible is going to happen to Salem if you don't help.
Principal Taylor turns bright red, and his thin lips twitch.
Leave you hanging? Choice words, Miss Dennison,
he says.
If anyone should have a guilty conscience over leaving anyone hanging, it's your father.
At my look of confusion, he pulls the door open a little wider.
Didn't know that about your dear old dad, did you?
He asks, raising his voice.
Well, he's the one who should be making up for old times.
He... I trail off, not sure what to say or where this is going. What are you talking about?
I did try to get cigarettes and lunch money from your father. Sure. I even tried stealing candy from his brat of a little sister. And then loony witches locked me and my best friend Ernie in cages. That was bad enough. But it was Max Dennison who left us for dead on Halloween night, after they summoned those three witches in the first place. Never you mind what happened.
I falter and look from Travis down to Isabella in shock. Principal Taylor knows the truth about the Sanderson sisters coming back? Principal Taylor was there 25 years ago, and Dad left him and Ernie for dead?
Well, good news is you got out in one piece, says Travis sheepishly.
I glance back at Principal Taylor. His eyes have gone wild and slightly unfocused, as if he's landed right back in that cage from 25 years ago. He shakes his head at Travis's words.
I had no idea, I say. So you know about the Sanderson sisters?
Oh, I know all about those three. After they locked us up, they were going to eat us. If Ernie and I hadn't taken turns screaming, he says, voice rising again, no one would have found us. But we did scream, and they did find us. And then Max Dennison, again your father, in case that is still not clear, spread a rumor that Ernie and I did it to ourselves, wandering into the old house and thinking it would be funny to get in the cages, then losing the key. And you know what? The whole town believed him. Do you know what that's like, Miss Dennison? To realize people you've known your whole life would rather believe the new kid than believe you? To know that someone would do a thing like that, like leaving you locked away in an old haunted house a quarter mile from town without food or water and then never apologize, never even acknowledge it, for 25 years. Why, Ernie moved all the way to Oregon to start a new life as a park ranger. Said he didn't want anyone to be lost and scared the way we were that night. No, no. I don't owe Max Dennison or his family squat.
He goes to shut the door again. This time I shove my foot between it and the door frame. The door bites hard into my boot, and I wince. I don't want to believe him, but I saw the cages in the house, and he knows about the Sanderson sisters. This isn't a story someone makes up, and especially not Principal Taylor. I've also never heard him say so many words together at once. I'm sorry, I say, because it's clear someone has to apologize on my dad's behalf. He looks at me, skeptical, and I sense there might be a chance to get him to help us. We have to ask him if he knows anything about the Blood Moonstone, get to Winter Island, and locate the stone. Right now, we don't even have a car. I promise I didn't know, I say. But since you've encountered the witches before, then you'll believe me when I tell you that they're back, right here in Salem.
They're back?
His face goes ghostly pale. Yes, my mom and dad and aunt are in hell right now, and the witches are out there doing who knows what, and they turned Isabella into a dog.
It's true, she says.
Principal Taylor screams and jumps a foot in the air at the sound of her voice.
Do you know anything about a Blood Moonstone? Is there one at the lighthouse? She asks him.
He stares at her and stammers incoherently, and then his eyes sweep the night air behind us.
I don't know anything about that, he says. But you shouldn't be outside, and neither should I. We're not safe. Go on home. Go. Katie's out there somewhere, probably under their spell. Don't you want to help her? Says Travis. Katie is just fine,
Principal Taylor says, narrowing his eyes at us, but his hand trembles as he raises it to close the door.
But what about everyone else? I ask.
They'll be fine come morning, he says. They were last time.
This is different from last time, I insist.
He leans forward then, just over the threshold.
I wouldn't know, he says gruffly. Last time, I was locked in a cage.
I take a step back, and he slams the door in our faces. Then I hear the sound of the locks being bolted,
and heavy footsteps receding quickly into the house.
Well, that didn't go as planned, says Travis.
We're screwed, I say. Totally and utterly screwed.
That was some heavy stuff, he says. Maybe your dad was the jerk face, Pops.
Apparently, I say. Isn't there an old saying about how history has two sides?
Now, how are we going to find the Blood Moonstone? Isabella chimes in. It could be anywhere on Winter Island. We could spend months looking.
Well, I guess at least that's a start, I say. But how do we get there? Across the street, five little girls skip through the park holding hands. They're dressed as Tiana, Mulan, Cinderella, Belle, and Merida, and none of them is older than seven.
Go, little children, they chant in creepy angelic unison. Hither and yon, search in the starlight and up until dawn. Find stone and book with the Sanderson claim. Wrap them up and summon my name.
They unlink hands and scour the street, clambering into tree branches and running their fingers through the water of a fountain. Then they come back together, rejoin hands, and start the chorus again.
That's gotta be the least effective and creepiest way to assemble a search party in the history of man, says Travis. Let's maybe not be in the wide open, suggests Isabella.
We step away from the front door and crouch behind a tree.
What now? I whisper.
Even if Winnie has her little mob find the moonstone before we do, we still have this, Travis says, motioning to the spell book in his hands.
Right. Maybe you shouldn't be waving that around. Just a thought, I say, watching as another group of kids in costumes races through the streets chanting the Sanderson spell in unison. Travis chuckles sheepishly and tucks it under his lab coat.
Good call.
So we've got to find the Blood Moonstone before their search party does, Isabella whispers urgently.
Let's get to the lighthouse and start looking.
One small problem. The lighthouse is miles and miles away up the coast, and we don't have a car, I say.
Or any clue where on the peninsula the stone could be, Travis adds quietly.
Think, says Isabella, running in tight circles.
Will you quit doing that? It's making me dizzy, whispers Travis.
Just then, a car pulls up the driveway and parks, and Katie Taylor steps out. She's got warm-ups on under her shorts and a state champ sweatshirt on over her jersey. Her hair is tied up in a ponytail, which glows gold in the moonlight, and her zombie makeup has been scrubbed clean. When she sees us, she looks repulsed.
What the hell are you doing here? She yells.
I freeze, not sure what to say. Travis looks at me, shrugging. Isabella's ears stand straight up at attention. Katie approaches us with her arms crossed.
I should have known you'd be behind the zombies. Weirdos.
She's lobbing her usual insults, but her tone betrays her. Katie Taylor's definitely freaked out.
This is the last thing I need right now.
She's only inches away, and Travis and I step aside and let her pass as she beelines up to her front door.
Katie, wait,
I start, but Katie cuts me off.
No, Dennison. The whole town's gone full Night of the Living Dead, and I'm getting inside before they develop an appetite for brains or something. Get out of my way!
I spin around to face Katie. We know. We saw them, too.
My best friend is acting like she doesn't even know me. People are lumbering around, humming and singing like they've lost their minds, says Katie, turning the key in the lock.
Did she get a phone call? I ask.
What?
Jenny. Did she get a phone call? Did you see her pick it up? Katie leans against the door, huffs, and turns to face me, rolling her eyes.
Yeah? Why?
We know what's happened to her, I say, and we're trying to fix it. We can save everyone, including Jenny.
But we need a ride, Travis says.
Katie scoffs.
Why would I give you guys a ride anywhere? Forget it. I'm out. Coward. Says Travis.
Katie freezes.
Pretty pathetic for the captain of the soccer team to run and hide when the rest of the team needs her.
Travis says, a little louder.
Where are you going with this? I whisper to Travis.
Trust me, he hisses out of the corner of his mouth.
Katie turns, eyes narrowed.
You don't know the first thing about team sports, nerd. I know that when your team's out on the pitch and the other guys have you on your heels, the captain isn't supposed to hand the armband off and take a seat on the bench until things get easier.
Travis takes a step forward.
The captain's supposed to push through it, get ahead, find a way to stay in the game. The field's for those who can. The sideline is for those who cannot.
Katie seems to thaw a little at his words.
Good going, coach. Where did you get all that? I whisper.
I play a lot of FIFA,
he whispers back. Katie's hand leaves the doorknob, and something like resolve comes over her. She moves past us, back to her car.
Get in, she sighs. But if you're lying to me...
She's obviously too worried about Jenny to come up with the perfect insult. She climbs into the front seat, and Travis climbs into the back.
Katie, thank you, I say.
Katie falters then, and I realize she's just as shocked as I am that I've thanked her. She recovers quickly, a hand on the open door.
Your resting witch face doesn't fool me, sweetie.
I let her snide comment go.
How fast can you get us to Winter Island?
She considers this.
Depends on how many kids are blocking the streets.
But not too long, I'd imagine, she says. Then she glances at Isabella.
But do we have to bring the dog? It's going to shed all over my leather seats.
Yeah, I say protectively. The dog's kind of key to the whole thing.
Okay, she says. But you're paying to get the upholstery cleaned.
She slams the driver's side door shut. I slide in behind her, and Isabella hops up onto the seat between Travis and me before I close the door. The front door of Katie's house opens, and her dad runs down the walk to the driveway. He's pulling on an old faux leather jacket over his striped pajamas.
Katie, you come back inside this instant,
he shouts. He stumbles in his slippers, which actually remind me a lot of my dad's. Katie rolls down the window.
Stay inside, Dad!
She raises the window and locks the car doors. As she pulls out of the driveway, she mumbles, I can't believe I'm doing this.
Come, little children, on down to the bay.
As Katie's car pulls out onto the street, it's quiet except for the whir of the heater. Zombie kids fill the street, and Katie tensely maneuvers around them.
So if I drive you to Winter Island, you'll help Jenny get back to normal? Asks Katie.
Right, says Travis.
Why do you want to get to Winter Island anyway? Talk about random, says Katie.
There's something there we need to find to break the spell, I say.
Spell? Okay, you need to explain more about that, she says. Does this have anything to do with your family's bogus Sanderson sister story? Is this all some kind of sick payback?
No.
And you can start by telling us what happened to Jenny, I say.
Way to redirect the conversation.
Fine.
After your lame party, I went to Jenny's for a while, but she got a call from Bella Richards, says Katie over her shoulder.
Isabella lets out an indignant yip.
Hey! She starts. I lean in and whisper to her, maybe keep the talking dog stuff on the DL for now, one bombshell at a time.
Then I shoot Katie an apologetic look in the rearview mirror reflection. Katie glances back toward Isabella, frowning. She seems to shake it off, though.
I got a call from Bella, too. But I mean, who talks on phones anymore?
Katie continues.
Anyway, Bella must be as much of a freak as your parents because everyone started acting weird when they talked to her on the phone.
I clench my jaw hearing her call Isabella a freak, but take a deep, calming breath.
I thought that was a prank, too, Katie continues. Then Jenny went off the rails, mumbling about finding a stone and a spell book. And I knew she couldn't be joking.
Katie gestures out the window. A group of boys dressed as superheroes in red spandex and black boots have broken out shovels and started digging in someone's flower garden.
So, you know how to fix this? Says Katie.
Then that means you do have something to do with this, don't you, Denison?
I want answers, or you're back on the street faster than you can say witch hunt.
What?
No, I say. This wasn't me.
Then I remember that I am technically the one who summoned the Sandersons back. So I am, at least in part, responsible for this, whatever it is.
You're two of the only people in our class who are still normal, she says.
Well, normal for you anyway.
That's more than a little suspicious.
I'll admit that she has a point there.
If I'm right, and you're behind this, you're the only ones who can tell me what the hell is going on, and help me get Jenny back.
She seems more rattled than I've ever seen her. Her tone is as flat and irritated as it always is, but she's white-knuckling the steering wheel, and it's clear that she's a long way from nonchalant.
You really care about Jenny, says Travis.
How heartless do you think I am? Katie retorts.
At the speed we're driving, we leave town behind within minutes and hit the open road of the narrow, wooded Salem Neck. Katie turns on her high beams as we streak through a grove of trees that totally obscures the moon. A power line runs along the road on the driver's side. I watch the moon through the windshield. Its reflection stretches over the hood of the car. Isabella is curled up on the seat next to me, head up, and looking out the window. I can't get what Principal Taylor said out of my mind. How could my dad have done that to him? And how could he have never told me? Especially during all his talks about looking out for others and being a good person.
Does your dad ever talk about my dad?
I ask Katie. She purses her lips, then shrugs.
My dad doesn't really talk, she says.
Oh, I thought that was just a school thing, I say quietly.
It's cool,
she says, but I can tell she's lying. She pauses, then adds,
We were close when I was a kid. He'd bring me up here, and I'd swim in South Channel or Cat Cove while he worked on the lighthouse. Taught me how to fish and how to boat.
She shrugs again.
But he's, like, really paranoid, especially around Halloween, she adds.
I think about how my parents shared everything with me, and how Katie's dad kept his run-in with the Sandersons a complete secret.
He won't tell me why, but I'm not blind. It is something to do with your family, Poppy, she says.
I keep quiet.
I heard your story about the Sandersons and your family earlier today at Allegra's, and it's totally ridiculous. But when I was younger, my dad used to shut down any talk of the Sandersons. I'm starting to think that wasn't a coincidence.
It wasn't, I say. Your dad was there. He saw the same things. It's his story, too. He just hasn't told it.
Great. So both our families share the same strange story.
Katie pauses, like she wants to come up with a good zinger. But then she says,
Sorry I was such a jerk about that.
I lock eyes with her in the rear view, eyebrows raised. I don't think I've ever heard those words, or anything close to them, escape Katie Taylor's mouth.
It's all good, I say. And I mean it. So, what? The witches are back?
Katie asks sincerely.
Yes, I say. And we have to stop them?
Katie asks.
Bingo, I say.
Katie slows as the night sky breaks through the trees more easily.
Hey, says Travis suddenly. There's a spell in here to send evil spirits back to hell.
I look to my left and find Winifred's spellbook open in Travis's lap. He's looking at a page with intricate letters spelling out Gates of Hell. There's a sketch of a gaping pit filled with fire and smoke. He flips to the next page. On one side is a spell to reveal and destroy a succubus, and on the other a charm for flavoring newt livers. A shaft of warm yellow light hovers above the pages as he continues to flip, revealing more spells, with names like Spells to Resurrect the Dead and Magician's Pact, and Excruciating Punishments.
Don't open that!
I shout. Travis shuts the book with a bang. Katie jumps, punching the brakes.
What the hell are you doing back there?
She says, looking at Travis in the rearview mirror.
Nothing!
Travis and I shout in unison. Ahead of us, the road is blocked by a low metal gate secured with a chain and padlock. The
gate is little more than a triangle outlined with aluminum pipes, so it'll be easy to climb over.
We're here, says Katie.
She throws the car into park, kills the engine, and gets out. Isabella and I both turn to glare at Travis.
Do you remember zero of my family's story? I whisper to him.
Or what Elizabeth told us,
adds Isabella.
Until 45 minutes ago, their story was fake, remember?
Travis whispers.
That thing can call the Sandersons when it's open, I say.
Yeah, Poppy's right. It'll betray us the first chance it gets, says Isabella.
So whatever you do, I tell Travis, don't open it again. He rests it on his lap.
Don't open it again, he parrots. One accidental spell, and Sandy Sanderson over here thinks she's head witch in charge.
He looks back up at me, flashing a smile to show he's joking. I sigh loudly, giving him a sidelong smile, and open my door to let Isabella hop out. Katie is standing a few feet away, arms crossed over her chest as she surveys the poorly lit greenery of the park ahead of us.
Okay, now what?
She says grumpily. There are a few sporadically placed streetlights that look like they haven't been updated since my parents were hunting witches. The lighthouse is a darker smudge right on the water, maybe a mile away, but its light isn't on. It's mostly just a historic monument now, I guess. I can't imagine what it looked like here back when Elizabeth was alive. I try to picture her house and all the other homes, and I wonder where her husband would hide a moonstone.
I'm glad the Sanderson search party hasn't arrived here yet, says Travis.
That's comforting, I say sarcastically.
So what are we looking for again? Katie asks. And you're sure whatever it is will fix whatever's going on with Jenny and the rest of the town?
Yes, I say, hoping it's true, and hoping against all odds that it's even still here.
We're looking for a rock,
says Travis, climbing out of his side of the car. Katie looks over her shoulder at him.
Are you kidding me?
A magical rock, he clarifies.
Jesus,
she says, darting toward the gate.
Remind me why I agreed to help you guys.
Because you want to get your BFF back, Travis points out.
That shuts her up. The three of us climb over the gate, and Isabella squeezes through it. There's a small building in front of us, the booth where the park ranger usually sits and accepts payment for parking, but it's dark and deserted at this time of night. Travis enters it and returns with a shovel.
Score,
he says.
How old is it?
Katie asks us. I give her a confused look.
The magical rock you're looking for,
she says, using a tone that suggests she'll abandon me on Winter Island if I can't keep up.
Old, says Travis. Like, buried 300 years ago old.
She pauses to process this new information, then starts walking again.
If it's from the 1700s, it's probably buried here, in the middle of the green. The lighthouse was built in the late 1800s, and they ripped up a lot of the old buildings on the island when they turned it into a park in the 90s.
She leads us down one curve of the roundabout that encircles the booth, and then continues along a road that runs the length of the clearing before curving toward the lighthouse. She's practically Principal Taylor 2.0, and a fountain of lighthouse facts to boot. Perfect.
Where's your new BFF gone off to?
Katie asks me. As if on cue, Isabella runs beside her and heels.
Well, about that,
I say, trying to think of what to do.
You know, Bella used to be my friend, Katie says.
Like, when we were 10,
she adds, clearly expecting us to be skeptical.
Back when she actually still wanted people to call her Bella,
she sighs.
I don't blame you if you don't remember me or the nickname. Sometimes I don't think Isabella does either.
I wonder why they stopped being friends.
What happened?
Travis asks, as if reading my mind. Katie shrugs.
She was nice, and she was busy. Future SCOTUS cleric and all that.
I guess we just took two different paths. She always defended me, though. Even after we got to high school and people realized the principal was my dad. She wouldn't sit with me at lunch, but she never let anyone call me Tattletale Taylor without giving them a piece of her mind. She looks at me. I'm surprised she's not here now. You're her new charity case, aren't you? The insult feels phoned in, even for Katie, but it still hurts. I shrug and shove my hands into the pockets of my jeans. So much for playing nice. Isabella heads back to me and whispers,
I guess this would be a bad time to chime in.
I nod.
Fine. Let me see if I can sniff out this blood moonstone.
Isabella puts her nose to the ground and weaves among us. We all keep walking, returning to the head of the loop, where a thicket of bushes separates the road and the field. Finally, Isabella leaves the road and sniffs among the foliage, vanishing into the ferns.
I never knew you had a dog, Poppy, says Katie. So is he like one of those truffle-finding pigs?
She asks, jerking her chin at the bushes. I shrug again, though it's a better explanation than I could have made up.
She's a she, actually, I say.
Okay, says Katie.
So is she like one of those...
A bolt of yellow lightning forks through the air, making contact with something beyond the line of bushes separating the road from the small field beyond it. My stomach lurches.
Isabella!
I race toward the site of the lightning strike with Travis by my side.
You named your dog after Isabella Richards?
Katie asks, jogging to keep up. I shove my way through the bushes, which scratch at my legs and arms, and enter a grassy field to find a park bench, a few trees, and a clear view of the dark, vast ocean far below. I also find Isabella, who turns to me and wags her stumpy tail. Thank God she's okay. As for the patch of earth in front of Isabella, it's charred and smoking.
Sorry,
Isabella says.
I started feeling weird, like the air had too much static. But I didn't know that would happen. But I think this is exactly where we should dig.
She runs in a circle around the charred earth.
What, did lightning just show us where X marks the spot?
I ask, flabbergasted.
I'm not asking questions,
says Travis, starting to dig.
I wish Elizabeth were here to shed some light on what happened, says Isabella.
Katie looks around.
Bella? Where are you?
Isabella?
She corrects. Katie eyes the dog.
Very funny, she says. Ventriloquist much?
Not so much, says Isabella.
This time, Katie sees her mouth move. Katie stumbles backward, her eyes widening.
No,
she breathes.
No.
I take pity and walk over to steady her before she falls over from shock. There's the bench nearby, so I steer her over to it and help her sit down. Isabella follows us.
Okay, what the hell is going on?
Katie points at Isabella, who backs away.
Katie narrows her eyes at me. You owe me an explanation, Dennison.
I think of Principal Taylor telling me he doesn't owe my family anything. And for a fleeting moment, I imagine doing the same to Katie. But then I think of how that made me feel. And I know that she's right. I spill everything while Travis digs. I don't hesitate, even though Katie's expression moves from concerned to shocked to disbelieving right before my eyes. I even tell her about her father and mine, even though she admits she overheard everything I said to Isabella earlier at Allegra's. Was that only just today? I continue giving my dad's side of the story, and then her dad's side, and explain why we went straight for her dad's house and why he turned us down.
That would explain his paranoia,
says Katie, shaking her head. Travis's shovel makes a solid thunk.
Anything?
I call to him.
Just rocks and roots, he replies.
Beside me, Katie puts her head in her hands and lets out a deep breath.
Katie,
I say slowly, I know it's a lot to take in. She looks up at me with wide, desperate eyes.
This is unbelievable.
I shake my head. It'll be okay, I tell her.
We will find this Blood Moonstone and destroy it. And I'll get my family back. And you'll get Jenny back. And Isabella won't have paws anymore. Katie bolts up off the bench.
We're just a few hours away from daybreak, she cries out. We'll never make it!
Her words hit me with more impact than I expect, and I feel sick.
I got nothing,
Travis says and dumps out another shovel full of dirt.
It was a long shot anyway. I mean, digging where lightning strikes isn't the most logical reasoning.
He throws down the shovel and wipes his hands off on his lab coat.
So, who's hungry? That wasn't just any ordinary lightning.
Isabella pads over and walks a wide circle around Travis in the hole he's dug. She shakes as if trying to dispel water from her coat.
It's happening again, she says. You should probably move.
Travis climbs out of the hole and joins me and Katie near the bench. Isabella narrows in, sniffing and wagging her tail as her circle gets smaller and smaller until her nose is pressed against the edge of the pit. She sniffs one last time, then comes to a complete stop and stares off toward the shore, a distant look coming over her face. Silence sweeps over us, the sound of crickets seeming to arise out of nowhere, and a slight breeze is cold on my skin. Then comes a rumbling crash and another bolt of yellow lightning. It's so bright and powerful that we all shriek and stumble backward, clutching one another.
I told you to move, Isabella says. You didn't say how far,
Travis grumbles in response. What is happening? Are you having some kind of witch allergy? I ask. But instead of sneezing, you're lightninging?
Maybe, says Isabella. Your guess is as good as mine.
She goes to the precise point where the lightning touched down, which is just an inch or two away from the hole Travis was working on. As she digs, dirt begins to fly everywhere, settling in a fine dust over her back. After a minute or so, Isabella stops and shakes hard. She turns to reveal a limp, disintegrating pouch and spits it out.
Ugh, it tastes like death, she says.
I get up, walk over to her, and pry the damp bag open. I reach in and pull out a porous red stone. I hold it up to the moon, letting the light stream around the edges.
Yes, we found it. The Blood Moonstone, I cheer, holding it up high in my fist.
The lightning actually worked, says Isabella.
Yeah, what she said, exults Travis.
Whatever,
says Katie, approaching me.
Now what do we do with it?
We have to smash this thing stat, I say.
Totally, says Isabella. But how?
It's not working!
Winifred exclaims, exasperated. She paces in front of the sitting room windows of the large house they'd entered, but not a single soul scurries up with a Blood Moonstone or her precious spell book in their hands. Behind her is a fireplace, but the fire has long since died in the hearth, leaving a smell of burnt wood that Winifred finds strangely comforting. It reminds her of winter mornings spent eating hot raven's wing porridge while Mother fussed over a bubbling cauldron. Mother, who will be reunited with her soon, she thinks fondly and hopefully. Nearby, Mary is inspecting the table of food along one wall. There's a bowl with lozenges wrapped in white paper and attached to paper sticks. The wrappings all have faces drawn on them, some of them uglier than others. Mary sniffs one, then tosses it back. Instead, she picks up a long, pale thing and nibbles.
The sign says these are the fingers of ladies, she tells no one in particular, but they taste like cake.
She spits the stuff into one of the lozenge wrappers and returns the treat to its bowl. Sarah sits at a table in the other room. She leans over the memory box and sings diligently into it. But Winifred knows it's only a matter of time before her sister tires of spreading her song from one person to the next, or more likely, becomes distracted. A shiver of energy crackles through the air and over Winifred's tongue. She glances surreptitiously at Mary, who doesn't seem to notice anything is amiss. Instead, Mary is chewing something that looks like a brightly colored earthworm. Mary might be better at smelling children, but Winifred has always been better at sensing magic. That's why, she tells herself, she's the best suited to give directions.
Sisters, Winifred cries, trying her best to contain her excitement. Sisters, there is magic in the air.
Mary sniffs delicately.
The magic smells like macaroons, she says.
Or is it macarons?
No, that smell is from thy sister singing, dimwit.
Winifred hurries up the stairs and about the upper floor until she finds a door on the ceiling that, when drawn down, leads up into the attic. She crosses the low, dusty room to one of the small windows and crouches there, hands clasped in her lap and a grin like an overeager child spreading on her face. She waits patiently, and then she just waits. Then Winifred feels something else, right there in the attic, so close to her. Her eyes comb over cardboard boxes and stacks of plastic bins, and she wonders what it could be. But then, as quickly as it came, the wavelength of magic dissipates, and she slouches and sighs, redirecting her sight back out of the window to try and pick up the energy she first detected. Winifred's confidence is beginning to lag when a second roll of distant thunder pulls her attention to the far coast in the distance. A bolt of yellow lightning springs out of the clear sky, a storm cloud forming and then dispersing as soon as its energy is spent.
The girl,
she says, pushing away from the window and hurrying back downstairs.
The feral, flea-bitten mutt has found it for us.
Sarah looks up from the memory box on the table, blue eyes hopeful.
May I stop?
She asks sweetly.
Yes, Poppet.
A voice rises from the speaking box.
Hello? Hello, Isabella. Are you?
Sarah presses a bony finger against the device and silences the voice. Winifred opens the front door of the house. Its yard is plain, unlike the houses nearby. In fact, the only mark of decoration is a small hand-painted sign beneath the porch light, which reads, The Denisons.
Book!
Winifred calls, as one would call for a dog, or a particularly doltish spouse.
Book!
Nothing happens.
Book! Come to mummy now!
Mary comes out behind her, clinging to the doorframe.
They've still got it, Winnie. Remember? She says timidly.
Of course I remember!
Winifred shouts. Then she softens, looking out into the dark, cruel world that has stolen her poor book.
Those blasted children are keeping it from me. What gives them any right?
Well,
Mary says, with little more confidence than before,
the girl is our great, 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 great...
Silence!
The look Winifred gives her could melt gold.
That meddling creature is no relative of mine, Winifred says. No more than, well, Elizabeth.
She retches at saying her name.
That is not really for thou to decide, though, is it?
Asks Mary. Winifred huffs and hustles back inside.
She makes me ashamed to be a Sanderson.
The girl did find the stone before thee,
says Mary, cowering as she says it. This time, Winifred turns very, very slowly on one heel to face her sister.
I do not need reminding, she hisses. Sarah!
She turns quickly then, becoming more herself.
Sarah, dear, please do your little song again and have the children tell us where that dog and my book and my...
She pauses and corrects herself with a strained gulp and forced smile.
Our stone has gone.
But thou said I was finished,
Sarah whines, rubbing her neck.
And now I say thou art,
Winifred says.
Mary, find us something on which to fly.
She eyes the shining chandeliers and polished mantle, top lip curling in distaste.
There must be a broom somewhere in this hideous place.
Yes, Winnie.
Mary bows and ambles into the next room. Sarah coughs and swallows, wishing she had a pint of scorpion juice for her dry mouth.
Cadaver, cadaver, cadaver,
she sings songs, correcting her pitch and relaxing her lips and tongue.
Bloody bones, bloody bones, bloody bones.
Satisfied, she presses the button, clicks the next name on the list, and waits patiently as the speaking box casts its spell. It makes a soft chiming sound, then pauses and repeats the noise.
"Hello?"
says a voice, sounding somewhat dazed.
"Hello,"
says Sarah brightly, and then she begins to sing.
"Come, little children, on down to the bay."
Winifred smiles with satisfaction and turns away from her sister. She goes over to the buffet table, picks up one of the lady's fingers Mary discarded, and takes a tentative bite.
"Hake indeed," Winifred says, spitting the wretched thing onto the floor.
Hashtag spell on you. I set the pale, round blood moonstone on the grass, and we all stare at it, transfixed. I'm sitting next to Travis on his muddied lab coat, which he spread out on the ground. Katie sits cross-legged on the bench across from us. She's pulled out her cell phone and is typing away, probably trying to pretend that none of this is happening. Under the circumstances, I don't blame her. I can't help feeling sympathetic toward her, with our shared family history and all. Isabella paces beside us. I still can't get over the fact that she's now a canine. Or any of this night, really.
"So, let's take the shovel to it already," Travis says.
"How do we know that would do the trick?" I ask.
"I don't know. What if we threw it in the ocean?"
Travis muses, miming tossing an invisible rock over Katie's shoulder.
"But that won't destroy it,"
says Isabella doubtfully, still trotting back and forth.
"We should get the police is what we should do,"
mutters Katie. Travis, Isabella, and I exchange a look. Like, that'll do any good? "I'm not sure that'd go over so well. It never seems to work in the movies," I say.
"You're right. Besides, I already called them," Katie goes on, talking mostly to herself.
"And my tax dollars apparently don't fund enough phone lines for DEFCON witch-level emergencies."
"Okay, back to what Isabella said," says Travis.
"Would it crack if we threw it in a fire?" I ask. "Don't some rocks crack if they get thrown in fires? Is that a thing?"
"Yeah, maybe,"
Isabella snuffles along the side of the stone.
"It's too bad the kiln is broken," she says with a grin. "I bet it would have actually worked in this case."
"What if we climb up the lighthouse and drop it onto the rocks below?" I ask. Travis scratches his chin as he looks at the top of the lighthouse in the distance.
"I don't think it would make a dent."
"I mean, we could try it," I say. Travis lifts his shovel and brings it down hard on the stone. The head of the shovel shatters with a thunderous bang. I shield my face as metal shards fly every which way.
"Holy crap!"
I shout. Travis's jaw drops and he holds up the shattered shovel handle.
"Well, we can rule out cracking it with the shovel,"
he says in a daze, tossing the broken handle off to the side.
"I hate to break it to you guys,"
Katie says, holding out her phone so we can clearly read the bright screen,
"but we're about to be surrounded by witch zombies."
"What?"
says Travis, leaning in toward her phone. On the screen, under the list of trending items, are Salem, Massachusetts. Zombie hordes converge on the sleepy eastern seaboard town and move toward Winter Island. Hashtag spell on you. Cell phone calls reportedly hypnotize thousands on Halloween night. And Rihanna teases new album and latest Instagram post. Katie takes her phone back and taps around on the screen, then reads aloud,
"Emergency lines are being overwhelmed as worried friends and family report their loved ones' strange behavior. Although the damage is concentrated in Massachusetts and surrounding states, with the hordes reportedly now heading in the direction of Winter Island, calls have been reported as far away as Seoul, South Korea. Authorities have urged the public to turn off their phones and avoid calls, even when they seem to come from recognized numbers, since those who are afflicted have used conference lines to entangle up to 5 recipients at a time."
She looks up at us, her face lit eerily by the light of her phone.
"Talk about 6 degrees of separation," she says. "I don't think that's how that works," says Isabella. Well, hopefully we can figure out how to destroy this stone before the zombies get here, says Travis. What if we tried?
Guys?
Katie says, startled. Her eyes are wide. She lifts her phone in the direction of the tree line and points.
They found us, she breathes. I knew I hated crowdsourcing.
We all turn and see specks of white light coming through the trees. I realize the lights are phones, their lock screens blinking on and off as the people carrying them stumble over rocks and tree roots. Dozens of kids and teenagers wander, zombie-like, through the dark woods that connect Winter Island to the rest of Salem, drawing nearer and nearer to us.
This is so not good.
Where do we go?
I stand up.
We can't just stay here.
I'm going to tweet at the governor, Katie says, typing madly. Bella, isn't there anything your dad can do? He's the mayor, for crying out loud.
Katie, I think we should move, says Isabella.
Now!
Travis stands and snatches up the blood moonstone and spellbook. Over the sound of wind, I can hear the advancing crowd humming the eerie spell song. They're so close now. There's the rustling of leaves, the snapping of twigs. Katie yelps and runs over to join us, and Isabella follows, hiding behind Travis. We put the park bench between us and the zombie horde.
As if a few pieces of wood and metal can help protect us?
Behind us, the cliff drops off to the ocean.
We're trapped.
But I'll be damned if I won't fight to protect my friends.
The bewitched kids close in quickly. Teens still in their Halloween costumes stagger toward us, their faces expressionless, their hands outstretched. They're all chanting under their breath, "Find stone and book with the Sanderson claim," they utter in monotone unison.
"Wrap them up and summon my name. Find stone and book."
"The stone!"
A teen girl in a soccer uniform gasps, pointing at Travis's closed fist.
"Jenny!"
cries Katie, stepping out from behind the bench and moving toward her. I put an arm out and stop Katie in her tracks.
"Katie, she's not herself."
"The book!"
another bewitched teen yells, charging toward us.
"So, this is an interesting turn of events," says Travis, girding around the bench. "Since we're surrounded by water and all."
He leaps out of a zombie kid's path and tosses the book to me.
"Catch!"
I take it, tuck it under my arm like a running back, and race toward the cliff's edge and away from the zombies with Travis, Katie, and Isabella close behind.
"We could jump, but we'd never clear the rocks,"
Katie says, scanning the ocean far below.
"Well, that's helpful," Travis says sarcastically. "Pops, I think it's time we open the book and look for a flying spell."
We all spin around. My heel digs into the dirt. One more step back, and I'll fall. The zombies have formed a solid line and advance slowly, with only 5 feet separating us. Now 4 feet. Isabella takes a firm stance, staring them down. She's brave, even as a dog. But as much as I deeply admire her pep, I have no clue what we should do.
"Isabella, can you make that lightning hit them?" I ask her.
"I'm not sure,"
she says.
"It's okay,"
I say, at a loss for any other ideas. In the assemblage, I recognize a few kids from school. A zombie teen I've never seen before, dressed as a stormtrooper but missing her helmet, lunges at me, and I take a step back, lose my grip, and feel the earth fall away beneath me. Katie catches my hand, and my body slams into the side of the cliff, dangling.
"Help!"
I scream, trying not to let go of the spellbook. Far below me, the ocean rumbles, and waves spray white against the sharp, craggy rocks.
"I got you!"
Katie yells over the wind. Travis joins her, and together they pull me back up. My feet try to find footing in the crumbling soil. And finally, I'm bent over back on the cliff's edge, trying to catch my breath. The zombies grab my friend's shoulders. Isabella valiantly rips at the fabric of their costumes in an attempt to fend them off. I stand up and push them away, but they keep coming, keep pressing in on us. Over the tree line fly three figures outlined by the moon, unmistakable even in the dark night. A blanket of stars wraps heavy around their shoulders, Winifred cackles as they descend, their clothes catching the light of the moon. Mary is riding a Swiffer, rocking dangerously on its swiveled base. Sarah is perched on a Roomba, swinging her legs as she descends, and Winifred is